I'm your host, DJ SusD, on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. All right, so today I have Dan Orsbeck from the Oregon Clean Power Co-op. This is a co-op that installs solar panels here in Oregon that you can invest in even without so here's a way for you to invest in renewable energy even without installing solar panels on your house. Or you can get solar panels installed in your house too, but he has projects. They have a lot of projects that they do with commercial properties. And it's very difficult to get investors here in Oregon to do solar. So that's why this co-op was started. All right, so that's coming up here on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. Please support independent media. And check out our newscast. And Sam Broadway will bring you all kinds of information on the COVID debacle, on the deforestation virus, and all the vaccine opportunities for you. So, and don't forget Dr. Zoom on Sundays. So yeah, coming up on Talk is Cheap is Oregon Clean Power Co-op, Dan Orsbeck with the Oregon Clean Power Co-op here on KPW LP 97.3 FM. Please support independent media. It's the only place you're going to get the truth. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. So, I'm talking with Dan Orsbeck of the Oregon Clean Power Co-op. You want to give us a little bit of your bio, and you're the general manager and of Oregon Clean Power Co-op, and how'd you get involved with them?
I've been in the solar industry for more than a decade, and I started out working for some of the large commercial solar developers building solar farms around the country. Initially in New Jersey and the East Coast. And then I moved back to Oregon a number of years ago and teamed up with a number of people who were all thinking along the same lines, which was how do we solve the problem of community organizations in Oregon having a hard time getting solar, and at the same time, people, community members who wanted to put their money to work locally. Particularly in renewable energy. So that was the genesis of the co-op, those two ideas coming together.
Well, yeah, and what? So first of all, does solar work in Oregon where we have so many clouds up here? Does it work? And, I mean, we have hydroelectric up here, so Although that seems to be getting pretty expensive. Hydroelectric isn't as cheap as it used to be. So, yeah, does solar work up here?
Yeah, it does. So, you know, there's always, I like to say I'm a dog owner, and there's never a day, 365 days a year here in the Willamette Valley, that I can't take my dog out for a walk without it raining. So there's always some point during every day of the year when there's some clear sky. But the big picture is that solar is part of an overall energy picture. We get our power from a variety of sources, and it depends where you are in the state or in the country for that matter. And the mix, of course, is changing. Oregon voted a couple of years ago to remove coal from the mix. So some of us in Oregon still get some of our power. If you're in Pacific Power Territory, you still get about 56%, I think, of your power from coal. It comes from Montana and Idaho and Colorado and Utah. We do get a lot of power from hydro. Every source of power has its own pros and cons. So there's no source of power that works nonstop year-round with no issues, whether those are technical or financial. So solar has pros and cons. Obviously, it only works during the daytime unless you add batteries, but it also has lots of strengths. It's clean. Obviously, it's able to be distributed, which a coal plant or a hydro plant can't be.
All right, so... What's the deal then? What is holding up solar? Why is it so hard to get solar panels here in Oregon? What is the problem with investors in Oregon?
Well, it's not just in Oregon. The primary incentive in the U.S. for solar is tax credits. Now, contrast that with Europe, say Germany in particular, which has a feed-in tariff, which is essentially a higher rate that you get for renewable energy, whether it's wind or solar. Oregon had that for a while, but it went away a number of years ago. So what that means is it's easier for someone who owns their own roof, owns the panels, put up solar, than it is for a community organization which is a nonprofit. So, you know, we formed the co-op 5 years ago, or almost 6 years ago by now, to serve that community, that group of community organizations. So we've done about 20 projects right to this point for nonprofits. We've done the library in Lakeview. We've done the city of Hood River County. A number of projects in Corvallis for the school district and Benton County, a number of faith-based organizations, churches in Portland and Beaverton and in Eugene, schools, nonprofits, local governments. So that's who we serve.
Well, but why is the co-op necessary? Why aren't SB 1520 is an initiative that passed here to encourage investment in solar panels, right?
Yeah. So the problem was that there was no easy way to invest in a solar project in your community. Now, you could always give a donation, you know, so if you're a member of a church congregation, say, and you wanted to help your church get solar panels on the roof, you could make a donation. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. You can get the charitable deduction. But not everyone can afford to do that or wants to do that. So until we came along, there was no way for you to actually put your money to work to put solar panels on the roof of, you know, your church or your kid's school or your town library and get your money back and make a return. So we operate under a securities exemption from the state of Oregon, from the Oregon legislature, that lets us do small stock offerings. And we call those crowd vesting. Like crowdfunding, but it's not a donation, it's an investment. Minimum investment's $1,000, and we pay people back typically over 10 years. And we use those funds to put up the solar projects that I've been talking about.
All right, and so why do we want to stay local? I know we're on a fault line here, and they're predicting a huge disaster here in Oregon. And of course, Texas is in the news that apparently they have their own grid that they're off. They're not connected to the rest of the country, but it still has been a disaster there. So why do we need local power generation?
Well, so there's two aspects there. There's the community and financial and economic angle, and then there's the energy aspect. So let's talk about the financial piece first. The invest local movement, if you will, is not just about solar. There are lots of reasons to keep money circulating in the local economy. You can find better sources than me to talk about that. We believe and we have found that there is a huge desire among people to invest locally, and particularly in renewable energy projects locally. So there's something very satisfying about being able to put your money to work for your community, as opposed to just putting it in the stock market, say, and helping some multinational corporation.
Well, yeah, that's the only place your money's going to end up in the stock market is.
Pretty much, yeah. If you are an individual investor and not, what they call an accredited investor, so a rich investor, you have basically two options, right? So you can invest in the stock market, whether that's individual stocks or a mutual fund, or you can buy real estate. This is another option, and we've had a tremendous response, so we know that we're tapping into a need, if you will, that has not been served.
Right, and it keeps your money local instead of sending it out of your town. So
you can walk by the building and see the solar panels that you have actually funded on the roof, mm-hmm. Or on the ground next to the building, people get a lot of satisfaction out of that, and people want to do something about climate change. For a lot of people, I think it's very frustrating that they've got money, whether it's in a savings account or in a mutual fund or whatever, and they're not able to do something about this problem that they see immediately facing all of us.
Well, yeah, and the sustainability funds, I notice from my research, they're just investing in tech companies. They're not investing in solar or any type of true sustainability.
Yeah, I mean, there are some investments, and I'm not an investment advisor, so, but you could buy Tesla stock. Tesla's doing great things for climate change. It's a big company. It's not that immediate connection to the community, and we are driven. The guiding philosophy, if you will, behind our co-op is community. I mean, co-ops in general. That's one of their values. They are community-based. So we differ from a company, a C corporation, for example, in that we are owned by our members and we are governed by our members. And we have a value to serve and give back, not give back, but to serve the community as well as to make a profit. So, a C corporation is purely driven, as I said earlier. It has only one legal requirement, which is shareholder value. So its job is only to do one thing, which is to make a profit and give that to its shareholders.
Well, and just to get into philosophy a little bit here, and this isn't really socialism. This is just pooling your money together, or communism or whatever. This is just pooling your money together to get a better deal and to keep your profits in the community, in a community or in the community. So it's not anything. And the co-ops have been around for many years, including farmers that used to buy things at a better price.
Yeah. I mean, co-ops have been around for a couple hundred years. And I would wager that if you say co-ops are socialist to any farmer in Oregon, they would laugh at you because ag co-ops are exceedingly common, not just in Oregon. Tillamook the Grange Co-op, but nationally, Land O'Lakes butter, Sunkist. I mean, almost any large agricultural commodity nowadays comes from or is involved with a co-op.
Right, I always buy treetop apple juice too, because they're
co-op. I mean, you know, I would wager that anyone listening today is either a member of a co-op or has done business, whether they know it or not, with a co-op in the last 24 hours, let's say, whether that's a credit union or an rural electric co-op or a food co-op or an agricultural co-op. I mean, I call it the hidden business model, because they're really widespread, but they don't have a lot of visibility.
All right, so we'll get into how the co-op works in a minute, but I just one more thing on this line of questioning is something I'm always curious about is why commercial properties like I used to work grocery, and I don't see why we can't have a solar parking cover on these grocery stores and other commercial buildings. What I mean, it's because it has to do with the lease and the way they're owned. You know, you see these build-to-suit signs where the landowner will build the building for the renter. So how does that work, and why aren't we getting more solar panels on top of these commercial buildings?
Well, I mean, there's a variety of issues there, and we've been looking at this for a number of years. So one thing you mentioned was carports, and those are expensive. So you'll see them a lot in California and the Southwest, where they pay higher rates of power and they have more sun, so they make more sense economically. They're just hard to do in Oregon. We're doing one right now, but it's very expensive. But the real question you're asking there has to do with ownership of the property and the tax structure and the tax credits for solar, and the fact that a lot of times the organization, the company in the building, doesn't own the building. So right there you have an issue, because they can't put solar panels on the roof because they don't own the roof. So it's more complicated than it seems. There have been a few instances where people have tried this, but it's just not simple. We have a partner organization that has been working with doing this with low-income housing, for example. Right, so the people who live in these affordable housing developments don't own their roofs, so they can't put up solar. So this company, which owns the buildings or manages them, has been putting up solar on the roof, but it's not at all simple because energy subsidies that the tenants get from the federal government go down if their electric bills go down. So if you put up solar and reduce their electric bills, there's no benefit to the tenants. So there's some policy changes, that have to catch up with the new energy environment that we live in.
Right. Okay. So the co-op itself, the shares are $1,000 and you pay 4% over 10 or 12 years. Is that
right? Yeah, but typically. So, right. So you become a member of the co-op, $50 for a lifetime membership. You also, at the same time, if you're not already a member of our partner organization, which is Solar Oregon, you join that. And then you can invest in as many projects as you want. Our minimum investment is $1,000. Technically, it's a share of stock, preferred stock. And so you put in our minimum investment is $1,000. Our average is probably, nowadays probably around $6,000 or $7,000. But the nice thing is, you can put in whatever you want. And then you start getting paid back after a year. So after the first year, and this is as the solar project starts generating revenue, and it does that by saving money. So it lowers the electric bill of the school or nonprofit or whatever building it's on. So that's a stream of savings that then is used to pay you back. So after the first year, you get some of your investment back, and you get interest on whatever money we've had, which would be the full amount the first year. And then the second year, you would get interest on however much we have left, and the third year on that amount, and so on.
So you get some of your principal back too. after a year?
Yeah, each year you get some of your principal back, and you get interest on however much the principal we still hold.
All right, and then you're putting there's a whole range that we can't go into right now in the interest of time of plans that the project follows, from ownership to leasing. So you can pay off the solar panels, though. You can buy the solar project.
Well, so there's two different aspects here. So there's the what we call a community investor, the crowdvesting piece I've been talking about, and that's the money we use to build the solar projects. Then there's a whole different piece which has to do with how we fund the solar projects. So we don't. It's not enough to just use a community investment. We use a bunch of other sources of financing. And there's a whole range of options, and that gets complicated. And it depends on the needs of the individual school, church, nonprofit, et cetera, and what we can put together. So sometimes that's grants, sometimes it's donations, sometimes it's we're able to make use of the tax credits, and other sources.
Well, I should point out, this is all for information purposes only. You should consult a financial advisor for all this. But it sounds like it makes it a little less risky if you have other players. Like I noticed Banner Bank is one of your investors.
Well, they want to finance one of our projects. I think we're going to talk about the Lakers Harvest about. Research project with OSU on solar and farming. They want to invest in that project, but we haven't taken investment for that yet.
All right, and so I thought you wanted to talk a little more about the Texas and the earthquake potential here that we're having for disaster.
I'm somewhat passionate about this. So it's a big topic, but the bottom line is that we're living in an age of transition where our energy grid is transitioning, and it's going. I draw a parallel with the computer industry. So, 50 years ago, the computer industry was centralized, and you call it the Soviet model, right? It was centralized in one way. So you had a mainframe living in a big data center somewhere, and the information flowed out to what they call a dumb terminal, and then back. And it was a very sort of linear and one-dimensional. Contrast that with the computing environment today, where it's a distributed environment. So you've got a computer, that you're probably listening to this on, right, or in your pocket. Computer with a radio on it that we call a cell phone. You got computers in your car. Computers are everywhere. So we're in that same sort of transition with the energy world. The 10, 20 years ago, the energy world, the grid, looked like it did 100 years ago, which is to say the energy came from a large central power plant, whether that was a coal plant or a natural gas plant or a hydro plant or a nuclear plant, and it flowed one way down the wires to your light switch. So nowadays, that model has been completely upended, and you've got power flowing every which way and being stored in different places and generated by all sorts of different size and type of generators. So that's where renewable energy fits in this new, brave new world we're living in. The advantage that a distributed grid like this brings is it's more resilient. So what you saw in Texas, I'll come back to the Oregon situation, but I think what you saw in Texas was a failure of policy and the market. And the Wall Street Journalist had a great article analyzing this, and that was their conclusion. The Texas grid, ERCOT, basically decided that they would let the individual companies prepare for extreme events like what we just saw, cold weather events. But it wasn't economically in their interest, and so they didn't do it. So, you know, cold weather came along and the natural gas line pipelines froze. The coal piles froze, so they couldn't load the coal plants. One of the two nuclear plants that they had in South Texas had to go offline because their water supply froze. And the wind turbines, there's been a lot of attention paid to this. The wind turbines had to shut down because they iced up. You know, so of course you saw Sweden and Iowa and Canada all saying, oh, we can help you winterize your wind turbines because they work well there. So they didn't put the investment in Texas. So switch to Oregon now. And, you know, we also, our grid is also vulnerable, or I should say our energy supply is vulnerable in different ways. And we're starting to see that now with public safety power shutdowns, right, because of forest fires, wildfires. But, you know, the big concern, of course, is the Cascadia event earthquake. When Cascadia hits, we will be dark for 3 to 6 months. And certain corners of the state, like Lakeview and the Oregon coast, are going to be the last to be brought back online. So what we're doing is, in our very small way, is putting solar and battery systems up wherever we can. So we have about 10 projects that are going to have batteries on them. And what this does is we can't afford to put in big batteries, but we're putting in small ones. And what it does is it will mean that one building in a community will have power enough to keep lights on into the evening and charge cell phones, maybe keep a refrigerator running to keep medicines cold, run a microwave, that sort of thing.
Well, and heat.
So, yeah. Say again?
And heat, I mean, you'd be able to run a heater, I would think, during...
Yeah.
The problem in Texas.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Air conditioning.
Again, we can't solve the whole problem. So we're putting in, small battery arrays because that's what our projects can afford. There are a few demonstration projects with larger batteries. In fact, EWEB did one I forget the name of the school, but one of the Eugene elementary schools, right, which has a well on the property. We're doing a similar project in a year or so with the Corvallis School District.
Right, so the well pump would still be working even without electricity.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's you can get water, which is another problem they're having in Texas. Well, but so how culpable are the power companies? I mean, at the risk of, being overcritical of the power companies, I mean, they really are not – like this line that they want to stop building – they don't want to build new power plants. They're in favor of solar because they don't want to build new power plants. If it was up to them, they're more concerned with their return on investment. They would not build new power plants anyway. They would just let the grid fall to pieces rather than and just do the minimum amount. I mean, isn't that true? I mean, I remember when the only reason they're buying power from us is because of the Jimmy Carter passed that law in the 70s that made it mandatory that they buy power from us. They wouldn't pay us for power. And because I remember there was this thing called the golden switch when solar panels first came out. You had to pay an extra $10,000 because they claimed that your little tiny house solar system might overload their grid. So they needed to put something in between your house and their grid, and they charge you $10,000 just to connect to the grid.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big topic. In general, the utilities are not pro-solar, and they want to control, as they have been historically, they want to control the energy production, sources of energy production. So you can't blame them because, you know, that's what they are. These are entities who have one mission in life, one reason for existence, which is, as I said, to make a profit for their shareholders. But they're on the wrong side of history. And, you know, there are some really smart people in utilities around the country, and a lot of them are starting to get it. And there are utilities now, you know, Florida Power and Light, Duke, not Duke, but there's a bunch of utilities around the country that are major owners. Constellation Energy is what I'm thinking of, major owners of solar and wind farms. Pacific Power is actually, you know, now, I mean, they've been forced by the Oregon legislature in some sense, but they're talking about putting in major renewable energy assets. It's not clear if those will go in Oregon or other states. So they're, you know, being dragged along. By the people.
I noticed all the money is, I still can't get money to put solar panels on my house that I have here. It's very difficult to get solar panels, but yet, you know, a centralized power plant seems to get money from the government, and we're still paying people to run a line to my house all the time. And I keep seeing on the highway, I keep seeing bigger and bigger blades for these wind farms.
Yeah.
And the money goes to the wind farm I can understand because you have to go where the wind is. But still, I keep having to pay this model that I have to pay for a wire to run to my house. I don't see why we need that. I mean, and getting experimental, you know, the Tesla had this thing where you could pull. There's energy. There's static electricity in the air. They have to pull. I'm surprised we haven't researched this more. Put a little money into that research. That they still have to degauss these steel towers before they can work on them. They have to get the electricity out of the tower before they can even get on the thing to work on it. So there's got to be a way to this model that we have to pay for a wire to run to my house.
Well, there are off-grid homes, but I think where we're headed is the grid serving as the interconnection, if you will, between the various sources of power and the battery, if you will. So the grid, looking at it nationally, if you will, the grid in the U.S. has been called the world's largest machine. And in fact, the power lines running up and down the West Coast are the largest corridors for power in the world, I believe, certainly in the U.S. So there are, you know, there is power running from solar panels in Southern California and Arizona that will come all the way up and provide power to Oregon and Washington. And conversely, when it's needed, hydropower, electricity from hydro dams here will flow down and be used in California. So we're living in a highly interconnected electrical environment nowadays. And local generation is growing. I think we're still a ways away from people easily being able to afford living completely isolated from the grid. I don't see that as very common unless you're way out in the boondocks somewhere. Not that it's not possible. There are plenty of people doing it.
Well, but these the rebates you get don't pay for battery backup, is my understanding.
Well, yes, that's correct. And again, it depends where you are. So Eugene is, EWEB is not very supportive of solar, not supportive, I should say, at all. You know, if you compare that with Pacific Power or PGE.
Is that because we have cheap hydroelectric here?
Well, you know, EWEB has their arguments about why they don't think it makes sense. Yeah, they have hydro. They have some other generation. They're two sides of every coin. So BPA, so Bonneville Power Administration, runs the Northwest hydro plants. Historically, that's been very cheap electricity. It's getting more expensive. The reason that Boeing is located was located in Washington was because of cheap hydropower, because aluminum smelting was a very electrically intensive industrial process.
Right.
And so they went to where power was cheap. So EWEB gets most of its power from hydro, from BPA hydro. BPA gets most of its power from hydro. That's increasing in price. The rates are going to be renegotiated in the next few years. But it doesn't get all of its power from hydro. It gets about 10% from nuclear. So, you know, Eugene gets some of its power from nuclear and some of its power from what they call unknown, a small percentage. I forget. It's a few percent, 4 or 5% or something. So who knows? You know, that's because it's not specified. They buy power on the open market. It could be gas. It could be anything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's mostly clean power. But, you know, every power source, every power provider has its own pros and cons.
Well, then another idea I had was I did this in the 90s. I approached the power authority down in California and asked them, how can I do, can I group a bunch of houses together and then be a power plant as a group of houses with solar panels on there? And they looked at me like I was completely insane. And you know, that is a whole other rate that they would pay you. You would get, if you were a utility like that, you get paid much more money for the power that you generate than you do as an individual homeowner. So, but there's a bunch of hoops that you have to go through and a bunch of money that you would have to pay just to hook up to the grid is what I remember.
Well, you were ahead of your time. So California now has what they call CCAs, Community Choice Aggregation, which is basically community-level grids, community-level utilities. It started with Sonoma Clean Power, I think. There's now, gosh, I don't know, you know, a dozen, 20. And I would not be surprised if in 5 years that's the predominant model for power in California. And, of course, you know, California is kind of the pioneer. Where California goes, the rest of the country often follows. So, you know, that is one model. Oregon doesn't have that for what they call the investor-owned utilities, which is Pacific Power and PGE. There is now a community solar program. EWEB and Emerald PUD, I believe, have community solar programs. They're very small. And I believe there are programs where you pay more for the power. So we, you know, we don't take that approach. We believe that you should pay less for solar power. So yeah, there's a bunch of different approaches, and the world is changing. I think what you're seeing, sort of coming back to what we were talking about, utilities. I think the utilities that are not moving rapidly to renewables are on the wrong side of history. Or the wrong side of technology, because what you're seeing where utilities have failed to supply reliable power to their customers, and California is a prime example, is the customers are taking matters in their own hands and putting in their own solar arrays with batteries. Mm-hmm. So I was in Santa Cruz, 2 years ago maybe, when there were fires. And what fires in Santa Cruz, they were, I forget, you know, 100 miles away. But they shut down the power Monday morning in Santa Cruz when I was there, and everything was dark. You know, half the town was dark for the public safety power shutdown. So, you know, you're starting to see those now in the summers in Oregon, and people can't live that way. You can't run a business that way. You can't live in your house that way. So what it's doing is driving people to install their own solar systems and put in batteries so that they can keep their lives running. You know, and I bet you'll see a lot of that in Texas right. In the next year or two.
Well, and I was at, when the last environmental law conference, they were talking about the Tennessee Valley Authority, which has been notorious power generation entity. And I said to them, you know, have you talked to the investors? There's institutional investors that are invested in these companies. I think we need to get with the investors need to have some shareholder resolutions with these guys and to get them, because they're not maximizing shareholder, like you say, they're not doing what the shareholder maximizing shareholder profits when they don't adopt the latest technology. All right. So speaking of good investments though, some of these seem like they're pretty good investments. What's the investment that Oregon Solar Co-op,
Clean Power Co-op
is doing right now? It seems like a good investment to me because of the other partners that are involved in it.
Well, you know, I'll leave that to you, the potential investors and your investment advisors, your financial advisors. But so the exciting thing we're doing right now is a research project and community solar project combined in partnership with Oregon State University College of Agriculture. We're calling it Solar Harvest, and it's going to be at the OSU Extension Farm in the Willamette, the North Willamette Valley, up just off I-5, south of Wilsonville. And the challenge that we're seeing, not just in Oregon, but really globally, is where do you put solar? So, you know, we mentioned carports. Well, that's a great solution in some places. There's only something like order, I think, of roofs nationally that are actually suitable for solar. And when you add in the issues about who owns the roof and other technical issues, such as the age of the roof and whether it's facing north, which makes it not suitable, it's actually hard to find good places to put solar. So what's ended up happening is a lot of solar is now going on to agricultural land. And, you know, that's creating a conflict. What OSU and other folks are finding is there actually isn't a conflict if you combine solar and agriculture. So it's kind of non-intuitive at first because, you know, you don't think about growing things in the shade of solar panels. But it turns out that there are lots of advantages to combining solar and agriculture for both entities, so both for the solar panels, because solar panels work better when they're cooler. They produce more power. And if you've got plants growing around them, underneath them, they'll produce more power. And there are lots of plants, think of lettuce, for example, or spinach, that won't grow well in direct sun in the midsummer. So, but they will grow well if they're in partial shade. So OSU has found, for example, that the biomass under solar panels is greater because the soil moisture is higher. So obviously, you know, you're reducing the amount of water you have to spend on irrigation. So they've measured sheep, for example, both the stress levels of sheep, which they do by measuring cortisol levels in the fur, and weight growth. So there's some research happening on this subject, and what we're doing is building a solar project that's specifically designed to allow rigorous side-by-side research on plants growing around solar panels and plants growing in the open. So we have solar panels, and then next to it, open control plots, and OSU will grow various plants in both conditions and be able to do science. And that's a project that we're just about to start taking investment for, hopefully in the next month, maybe 6 weeks. And so we're taking a waiting list of people who'd like to invest in that.
Well, so, but I noticed a lot of your projects are government projects, like you do schools, and there's a Hood River water treatment plant. So isn't that, and again, all this, you need to research this yourself, and this is all for just informational purposes only. But, I mean, so doesn't that have the backing of the government? Don't those projects have the backing of the government in addition to investors so that there's a little less risk?
Right. So Solar Harvest is partnership with OSU. And we've done projects for the city of Hood River. We're doing, you know, I mentioned the coast earlier. We're doing an interesting project for a school district, Neocani School District, at the coast in the Garibaldi, Manzanita area, to put solar and batteries on two schools there because they're very concerned about not just earthquake, but hurricane and storm disaster hitting them and floods. They have ham radios in all their schools, and they have teachers and staff members in each school trained to use the ham radios. So if the grid goes down, they can stay in touch if they have power. So we're putting in solar and batteries to help them there. So yeah, we'll work with any sort of organization that, including businesses, that wanna put up solar.
All right, and so what is the interfaith? You talked a little bit about your churches that you're putting solar panels on. What is the Interfaith Solar Initiative?
Yeah, so we've done solar for a bunch of a number of churches and other faith-based organizations. Our one project in Eugene to date was for the Eugene Friends Meeting, our smallest project. And, you know, we have a lot of interest from those organizations around the state. So what we're doing is sort of combining all that into one larger initiative, if you will. We're partnered with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Their organization is called Interfaith Power and Light. And we want to reach out to churches and other faith-based organizations around the state and let them know that we are available to help them put up solar, and that there's a bunch of other kindred spirit groups wanting to do this at the same time.
All right, and then I talked to Michael. You're familiar with Michael H. Schumer, I know, from talking to you.
Yeah.
I talked to him a few weeks ago, and so give me a little bit about these accredited investors and the Jobs Act. And I thought there is a limit as to how much a non-accredited investor can invest in these. But you don't fall under that?
We don't, right. Michael Schumer is great. He was actually part of the inspiration, you know, 6-7 years ago, I think. I went to a seminar of his for creating this this co-op to let people invest locally. The Jobs Act was passed, I don't know how many years ago by now, 6-7 years maybe, and it provided various means for, you know, small investors and internet investors and crowdfunding and so on. I don't know how successful they've been. People have, you know, created their own approaches to, you know, including us. We don't fall under the Jobs Act. We have a separate exemption that allows us to sell stock, the exemption from the Oregon legislature. So we're in Oregon only. Our members must be Oregon residents. But yeah, the whole local, there's a great book. It's a few years old by now, called Locavesting. And Michael Schumer is doing great work.
All right, Dan Orsbeck from Oregon Clean Power Co-op. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Is there a future? What do you think the future of solar is going to be in Oregon?
Well, I think it's going to be bright, if you will. There's a lot of interest. And, you know, I think, as I've been describing, it's going to be decentralized, both in terms of where the energy generation is. It's going to be on roofs or, you know, next to buildings. And it's going to be decentralized in terms of who owns it. So it's not just going to be the large utilities owning it. It's going to be the communities. And that's what we are enabling.
All right. I keep getting your name wrong. It's Dan Orzek, General Manager
yeah.
of Clean Oregon, Oregon Clean Power Cooperative. All right. Thanks very
right.
much for your time. And
thank
good
you.
Luck to you. I hope it works for you.
Thanks.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was from the Oregon Clean Power Cooperative, The Risk of Being Capitalist. That's one thing I've found, is that it's the only way you can really get things done is follow the money and change the way how things are funded, and take money away from the bad guys. All right, this is KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peace Works Independent Community Radio. The show's talk is cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti. Here, listen to this for a second. Coming up is 80 Grit. We'll be right back.
Face of the Portuguese, they cannot act collectively. Nothing holds it together but an idea. There is no possibility of change in their life. In the face of the Portuguese, they cannot act collectively. Individually, they cheat. Corruption, spread disease and prostitution in the name of spreading knowledge from generation to generation until in 1,000 years
of your race.
matter if the war is not real, or when it is, victory is not possible. The war is not meant to be won. It is meant to be continuous. The essential act of modern warfare is the destruction of the produce of human labor. A hierarchy of society is only possible on the basis of poverty and ignorance. In principle, the war effort is always planned to keep society on the brink of starvation. The war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects, and its object is not victory over Eurasia or East Asia, but to keep the very structure of society intact. Be continuous. The essential act of modern warfare is the destruction of the produce of human labor. A hierarchy of society is only possible on the basis of poverty and ignorance. In principle, the war effort is always planned to keep society on the brink of starvation. The war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects, and its object is not victory over Eurasia or East Asia, but to keep the very structure of society intact.
Thank you for listening to KEPWLP 97.3 FM, Peaceworks Community Radio in Eugene, Oregon, and streaming online at kepw.org.
We are KPW 97.3 LPFM, also simulcasting at www.kepw.org, Eugene, Oregon's new community radio station.
Have you heard about the Toolbox Project? It's a local nonprofit.